Welcome to West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I am the Reverend Tracy Springberry, and it is a delight to be with you this morning on this late May morning as we are about to tumble into summer, a summer we hope is open and more free of COVID than it has been. You are welcome here. And I would love for each of you to take a moment to say good morning into the chat. That means other people know that you're here with them watching. I can see your names. It's always nice to know who's here. And I wanted to let you know that each and every one of you is welcome here. Whether you're watching Sunday at 10:30 or you're watching this later when it's been taped, you're welcome if you are fully vaccinated and visiting manically every public place you haven't seen in months. You're welcome if you are fully vaccinated and are moving more cautiously into the world. You are welcome if you are hoping to never wear a mask outside again, or if that still feels a little risky, taking the mask off. You are welcome if you are not vaccinated, or if you are partially vaccinated, and watch the high infection rates with dread. You are welcome if you or someone we live with can't be vaccinated for months, or perhaps ever, and are trying to negotiate what is now an unequal world. Whoever you are, however you are welcome here. If this is one of your first times with us and you did not get an order of service in your email, you can go to woof.net and communicate with our administrator, who will make sure that you get on our email list. And you can also learn how to engage with us as a community online and get to know people in some of our offerings. And today, after this service, we are not having coffee hour. We are having our annual meeting. And you should have gotten information about in your email about how to connect with that annual meeting. And I really recommend it. We've done the annual report in a new way, and it is just such a happy thing and a gift to all of you. So I really hope that you'll join the annual meeting today. So I light this chalice for all the stories that make up our faith. And the candlelight went out, so I am doing this with a match. Let us say our affirmation together. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another.
You Are Enough, by the Reverend Chip Rausch. You are enough. You are enough. Though perhaps beaten down, exhausted, lonely, distracted, overwhelmed by life's relentless complexities, you are enough. You are enough. You may be behind in your bill payments and ahead in your calorie intake. You may owe handwritten letters to a half dozen friends. Your bathroom may be messy, your kitchen even worse. Whatever the reasons that you feel inadequate or sorry or wrong, you are still enough. The spirit of life, which is pushing green buds through bare branches, which has produced blossoms from stalks that were nothing but hard ground, that spirit of life exists within you, too. Even if you are deeply grieving this morning, awash in memory and mourning, we wish you peace. May you eventually remember that you are enough. We believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all persons. You do not have to earn your worth. You cannot earn your worth because you are already enough. No matter what our troubles, whether or not we notice it, the universe is filled with love. The universe is full of love, showering us with it every moment. And that love is not only outside of us, we too are filled with love. The instant we remember that fact, we regain access to the care, courage, and compassion that is our human birthright. There is pain, yes. Each of us knows suffering of a thousand kinds. And amidst it all, we are held in love. We are held in love, and we have love to give, to hold and heal others around us.
This is the time for all ages. So you all know the story of Cinderella. Well, I am here to tell you the true story. I am Cinderella's stepsister. And no, I'm not evil, neither is my sister, and my mother is about the sweetest person you ever met. And Cinderella's father did not die. In fact, Cinderella was a smart, funny child who loved to tell stories. She told stories all the time. She was telling stories about the mice and how that they would help her with her chores, and she would dress them in clothes. She would tell stories about how she was a princess in the air. She would tell stories about how the birds talked. She would sometimes tell stories so endlessly that our father had to tell her to stop. And if she didn't stop, she would be punished and told to go stand in the corner next to the fireplace. One time, she turned around, threw up her hands, and said, "What am I, Cinderella?" Which is the real way that she got her name. It's true. The prince did have a great ball where he invited all the eligible maidens. It's not true that Cinderella didn't have any clothes and had to do chores all the time. In fact, her father bought her amazing amounts of clothes. But Cinderella didn't really care that much about clothes. She was always tearing them as she ran through the neighborhood talking to her birds or whatever she did. But on the day of the ball, she went into her room and she came out with the most beautiful blue satin dress covered in lace, and she had on these slippers that looked just like glass. She was beautiful, and she whirled around, and she said to everyone, "Look at the dress given to me by my fairy godmother." We just all had to roll our eyes. Then she rushed down the stairs, she rushed into the carriage, and had it gallop off towards the palace, leaving me and my sister behind to walk. Fortunately, it wasn't that far. But when we got there, we saw Cinderella, and there was a young man talking, and there was all kinds of people gathered around him. We assumed it was the prince. And Cinderella saw him and walked right up to him and said, "I'd like a dance." We were humiliated. Who says that to a prince? But he took her in his arms, and she told him how she was a princess from the air, and how everyone in her kingdom could do magic, and how the food was so delicious. And he told her stories about how he'd killed dragons and fought in the army. And they were the most beautiful, inspiring couple all evening long. But then the bells began to chime. In our house, the curfew was midnight. Absolutely. And if you didn't meet it, you were in a lot of trouble. And sometimes, yes, had to do some cleaning. Well, Cinderella was not excited about that. So she went running out without even saying goodbye and ran down the steps where she lost a glass slipper. But she didn't care. She had hundreds of pairs of shoes at home. She ran as hard as she could, and she got home on the last strike of midnight. Well, the next day, We all heard that the palace was looking for the princess with the glass slipper. And they did come to our house, and we tried on the slipper, and it fit Cinderella exactly, and she showed the glass slipper. "I want to marry you," said the prince, and she said, "Yes." But then, and we were all really proud of her, she remembered that sometimes it was a good idea to tell the truth. And so she said, "I have something to tell you. I'm not really a princess from the air. I actually live here in this house with my father and stepmother and stepsisters, and I understand if you don't want to marry me." And he looked at her and he said, "Oh, I do still want to marry you. And I have something to tell you. I'm not the prince. I'm the prince's second cousin, and I love to tell stories, too. I've never fought a dragon or even been to a war. Do you still want to marry me?" And she said, "Yes." And they were so happy together. They really were the perfect couple. They moved into a little cottage, and they loved to tell stories to each other. And somebody said, "You guys are such good storytellers. Maybe you should go into the folktale business." And so they did. Which is how you got the story of Cinderella that you know. And they became the favorite storytellers of all the children in the land. And they ended every story. And they lived happily ever after. This is our time for prayer and meditation. Dear Spirit of love and life, let us be grateful for our lives, for our breath that goes gently in and out, bringing the air we share with every living thing, uniting all life in a web of interconnection. Let us be grateful for the water we drink that makes our lives possible and that we share with every living thing, connecting all in a web of mutuality. Today, let us hold particularly the people of Israel and Palestine in our care as they recover from violence and are still stressed with fear. Let us hold close those who have COVID-19 throughout the world and in the United States, and those that every day come in contact with that suffering. And let us hold us all as we navigate the tricky, shaky world outside our homes. Let us show each person we meet compassion. Now let us take time for prayer, meditation, reflection, as is your tradition. I love the book Matilda. I'm a great reader of children's literature. And I have been fortunate in the last month to read two books, Flora and Ulysses and The Tale of Despero by the renowned children's author Kate D. Camillo. They are delightful stories about the real human struggles of love, loyalty, dreams, and being who we truly are. In both books, the character used stories to navigate their lives. In Flora and Ulysses, the main character reads comic books and is enthralled by the tales of Incantesto, a school janitor who turns into a stream of light and fights evil. In Flora's life, there is a superhero and an arch nemesis, and guidance from the helpful columns in the back of every comic book about how to deal with criminals and dangerous situations. In The Tale of Despero, which won the Newbery Award, the highest award in children's literature, a tiny mouse, Despero, bullied by other mice for being small and unmouse-like, reads a once-upon-a-time fairy tale about a princess and the knight who rescues her. As life events unfold, Despero sees them as the story of a brave knight and a princess. There are many reasons for the brilliance of Dee Camillo's tales, but one is how she makes central this guiding of our lives by the stories we tell about them. When Flora saw the story of her life as a superhero comic, she behaved in keeping with that story. When Despero believed his fate was to love a princess and be her knight, he behaved as a knight. And the truth is, we all do this. We create the story of our lives and then act according to the story we have chosen to tell about it. We pluck plots from our culture and map our lives onto them. We decide our character and those of the people around us. We live according to those characterizations. Our lives are made up moment by moment with experience. We nearly forget all of it. We remember what we remember because of the stories we tell about our experiences. Some researchers claim that even as we are living an experience, we begin to craft the story we will tell about it, that dreadful afternoon of errands. A version of the story, the details we choose, those we will leave out, how we will represent our character and the plot, will be nearly formed before the experience is even over. Cinderella, when visited by her fairy godmother, watched the magic unfold, felt the beat of her heart, her disbelief, excitement, watched shocked as the pumpkin became a carriage and the mice horses, and at the same time, her mind prepared to tell her beloved dog every last detail. When she tells her dog the story, this becomes her memory. And as she tells the story, he wags his tail particularly hard in the parts where the animals become humans. So she adds details to those parts. How the coachman, formerly a lizard, flicked his tongue between his lips. A mouse leaps into her lap as she talks, and she adds details about the prancing horses and the bells that rang as they galloped. She skips past the part where the fairy godmother used the blooming lilacs to decorate the carriage. When she is done telling the story, the new version that she has just told becomes her memory. And the first version, the one she made up to tell her dog, fades. Our mood, our temperament, our audience, our understanding of ourselves, the people around us, and our ideas about how the world works influence how we tell our story. If we are depressed, our stories have more negative spins. If we are delighted, more positive spins. If we believe we are responsible for everything that happens in our lives, we tell the story differently than if we believe life is unpredictable and stuff just happens. What happens to us later also influences how we tell the stories of our past. In the months after her marriage, Cinderella will tell the magical story of meeting Prince Charming, the immediate chemistry, what a gentleman he was, how they laughed and they both loved dogs. 10 years later, after 3 children and his endless affairs, she will tell her close confidants about that first meeting and emphasize how he kept exclaiming about her beauty as if it was the only important thing about her and didn't ask her any questions about herself, but instead spoke endlessly about how he was an excellent fighter and never missed a Cubs game, which she did not understand meant he went to every Cubs game in person. The way we create our stories is like a complex version of the game of telephone, where children sit in a circle and whisper a phrase in the next child's ear and wait to see what phrase comes back through the whole circle. It is rarely similar to the original phrase. And sometimes our stories aren't either. Psychologists do research on something they call flashbulb memories. Where were you when JFK was shot or when the Twin Towers came down? If we are old enough, we know these stories. We tell them with confidence. They are like a photograph flashed of the moment, clear to us because of the shock and emotion. We retell these stories many times in our lives. Psychologists have asked people to write where they were and how they felt the day after a major shocking public event. And then a week later, a month later, a year later, 3 years later, and 10 years later. And studies have shown that between 1 and 3 years after the event, 40% of people do not tell an accurate story about where they were and who they were with, and 60% are wrong about how they felt in that moment. At the same time, people are 100% confident their story is correct. It is flashed into their being, after all, and utterly baffled when they read what they wrote immediately after the event. Some even deny that first story and can't figure out why they would have lied to the researcher. Our stories, based on lived experiences, are revised until they become something else entirely, our understanding of our life. This is the important thing, however. We make up the stories we tell about our lives. We decide how to understand our lives. It is not written in the stars like Jack and Jill or Romeo and Juliet. Our personality, the stories around us, how we interpret our character and others' actions, what we understand to be cause and effect, determines how we will weave our experiences into coherent narratives. One story structure people often use to tell their stories goes, things were good, and then bad things happened. Cinderella's mother and father die. She becomes a slave for her stepmother. If the story ends there, this is called a contamination story or a tragic story. If this story, it becomes essential to how Cinderella understands herself, she may often feel that she's a victim of circumstance and has little control over the events of her life. She may talk about how it is difficult for her to love others because she is afraid they will die. She gets panicky when someone tells her to do something, remembering all those orders from her stepmother. Another story structure is a bad thing happened and something good came out of it. Cinderella's sisters tore her dress, but her fairy godmother rescued her. She was locked in a tower, but her prince found her. If this story is essential to how Cinderella understands her life, she may see herself as someone people feel is worth rescuing. She may see herself as a good and worthy person who loves easily. This story form, when good comes out of difficult experiences, is called a redemptive story. And this is Americans' favorite story. We got divorced, but we found our soulmate. We got cancer, but through the process of the treatment, learned to slow down and attend to our family. If we tend to tell redemptive stories, we are likely to seek out the redemptive and challenging times. What are we learning, we might ask ourselves? Where is the good in this suffering? The stories we will each tell about COVID-19 are still being written, but I know many people who are already using the redemptive story in their early COVID drafts, story drafts. COVID isolated me physically, and that was painful, but I ended up more connected with my family from distant places through regular Zoom calls, or I began to write, or I slowed down for the first time in years. Using the redemptive arc for one's stories opens us up for the blessing or the small good thing, whatever our circumstances are. It gives us a strong sense of agency and control. And psychologists have found people who tell more of these stories about their life It improves their sense of well-being. That said, though, the redemptive story is not always the best story form for our lives. It can be a bit oppressive as well. In America, we love this story so much that we try and force it onto people's experience. You have cancer. What are you learning? You just got divorced. You know, have you started thinking about the new person? When I was going through a very painful time in my own life, more than one person said cheerfully to me, "This experience will make you more compassionate as a minister." It was only with a great deal of self-control that I did not spit angrily, "I am already compassionate enough, thank you. I do not need this experience to help me." Other story forms also have benefits. The ancient Greek preferred the tragic form, and Shakespeare used it often. The flawed hero goes on some sort of journey, completely messes things up, and then dies or is banished. Things were good, and then they were just terrible. The end. No redemption. Sometimes the tragic form is the right form. When one is denied access to one's children by the court system because of a lying ex, or they are taken at the U.S. border, this is tragedy. When we betray someone, this is tragedy. Half of our family dies from COVID-19. This is tragedy. Out of tragedy comes lament, the pure agony of suffering. When we can just let that be and be present, this can lead to deeper connections with others who've also suffered. Tragedy reminds us that we do not control things, that both bad and good can just happen. Tragedy reminds us that sometimes we mess things up and we can't fix it. Tragedy is a story form that shows our vulnerability and how we are flawed. An essential part of our stories is how we craft ourselves. Do our stories often feature us as a victim of people and fate? Do we see ourselves as people who depend on community, sometimes need rescued, or can do it all by ourselves? Do we see ourselves as people with control over our lives, people with the ability to change our story? Matilda, in this morning's song, most certainly did. Does our story describe us as lovable, as worthy, as enough, as kind, as able to learn from experience? How we describe ourselves will make every difference in how we will interpret our current experiences and how we will act in the future. If we scripted our story with the lens that we are not enough and must always scramble for love, we will behave differently than if we scripted the story to show that we are worthy and lovable in every moment, and we are always enough. The wonderful news about all of this is we made up our stories, whether we noticed what we were doing or not. And if these stories do not serve us, we can revise them. Cinderella could tell a redemptive story about the long years she was bullied. She could credit her kindness to understanding how all that meanness felt. Or perhaps she will describe the bullying as tragedy, full of pain, that she uses to connect to others who have suffered. Maybe she will see in the story a girl easily victimized and always carry this vision of herself into new relationships. Or maybe she will see herself as a survivor who found joy even in the hard times and always can. Any of these stories could be true. It's all about how Cinderella has chosen to interpret them and tell them and live them. We can choose to tell our stories in ways that serve us. We can revise the story that we were victims of the bullying, to a redemptive story about what we learned and took away from that. We can just hold that pain without redemption, if there was no redemption, and just realize there's some things about life that are simply suffering, and hold ourselves in compassion. Our old stories can feel so written in stone, so unrevisable. They've been told so often and set our character and being that it can be challenging to think that we actually can rewrite them. We can challenge ourselves to sit down with them, to hold them, to put them on paper, to tell them to a loved one, and find a way that we can make peace with the pain in those stories and relish the joy in them and discover the worthy, lovable self. As I researched this sermon, I kept wondering if there is a way to tell a story that is particularly Unitarian Universalist. Not superhero comic or happily ever after or tragedy. A redemption, but a different kind of story. Maybe a story where we notice how love and gratitude, creativity, and mystery show up in different parts of our life. I think maybe the newest Disney version of Cinderella, or as we say in my house, the real people one, has some elements of a Unitarian Universalist retelling of the story. This story focuses on the way that Cinderella is infused with love from her parents, from the beautiful home where she lives, and the animals around her. As Cinderella's mother dies, she tells her to have courage and be kind. And Cinderella spends her life trying to live by her those words. But it's not always easy. The bullying in her home is truly awful. She flounders and despairs, loses her courage. But then she is caught by the grace of a fairy godmother. In this retelling, Cinderella has agency. She can always choose to be courageous and kind, no matter the circumstances. And she allows herself to be helped, to surrender to what is unexplainable. She connects with another trapped person, the prince, and she works hard to keep that relationship and connection alive. I wonder what our stories would be like if they emphasized the moments we were courageous and kind, when we were touched by grace, and how our relationships sustained us and helped us grow. I wonder if we told these stories about our lives, who we would be. As you begin to retell your story, let love guide you.
On the road from greed to giving. guide us through the hard night.
Our benediction is from Derek W. Alcott. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome, and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you. All your life, whom you ignored for another who knows you by heart, take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. We extinguish our chalice, knowing the flame of Unitarian Universalism is alive in our hearts and spirits, and so shall continue to light up the world.